Greetings, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea. This is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. And to the hostile invading alien armies hovering silently behind their cloaking devices just outside of Earth's atmosphere, remember, eat Harry and Meghan first. Now that they're going to be Canadians. Or at least that's what the gossip is all about these days on the news. Hey, big story tonight, should mention it. As we speak in Manila, there is a huge volcano. It's Manila, right? I think it is. A huge volcano is erupting, and it's spewing ash about 6,000, sorry, about 6 miles into the air, and it's covering a wide area. It hasn't gotten worse yet, but a hazardous eruption is imminent. People are fleeing. There's a lot of weather stuff going on, too, in this country. Yesterday, and then even probably for a large part of today, unseasonably high temperatures on the East Coast. I mean, some places like getting up into the 70s or something. Usually that means we pay for that on the other end, however. So that warm, moist air hovering overhead can produce some dangerous circumstances when more cold, dry air comes down behind it. So just keep that in mind. There are some new storm systems that are going to be moving across the country, and it could affect you. Keep your head on a swivel for Monday morning's commute, just in case. Check your local listings for that. It's going to be a big show tonight on Coast to Coast. In our first hour, we're going to talk with Jeff Mudgett. Mentioned him about 1,000 times last night. We had on Amaryllis Fox and her book about the CIA. The book was sort of marked her years as she was coming of age in the CIA. It's called Life Undercover. If you've got Coast Insider, go back and listen to that. It was big time fun and very interesting. But she worked with Jeff Mudgett on the American Ripper series that was on the History Channel. And he's going to update us on some of the things that have happened since the original 8 episodes ran. We'll get to that in just a moment. And then next hour, Mark Headley is back, blown for good. He was on about 10 years ago with me. It was so long ago, the book was in hardcover. And it was one of my favorite interviews from that period because he was an early voice in exposing what it meant to try to get out of the Church of Scientology. He since then has been featured in the documentary that everybody was talking about on HBO called like Going Clear and other media, and he is what they call fair gamed to this day. He gets fair gamed by the Church of Scientology, and we'll talk more about that and some of the things that continue to plague his life next hour on Coast to Coast. But first, if you go to coasttocoastam.com, I put up a story. And along with all the other great news items that are there at coasttocoastam.com, and there's some cool things about abductee interviews and this runaway tire that narrowly misses a restaurant employee. The video is up. If you scroll down to In the News, I couldn't resist, and I'm so grateful that Greg Bishop posted it. My 29-year-old son invented a word, and it's getting traction in the sustainability circles where he works. He works for a startup called Reaply, and they're working with universities and other large institutions in creating these circular economies, dealing with their surplus merch and trying to create a new way of dealing with things so they don't go into landfills. So he invented a word and it made it into a magazine called Green Biz. And the link is up at coasttocoastam.com under In the News. If you scroll down, you'll see it takes about 15 paragraphs to get to my kid, but he's there, my son Gar, and so it's there under In the News on the front there at coasttocoastam.com, and you can read about the word that he invented, which he's getting a lot he's getting teased for, but other people are going, you know what, actually, that's the perfect word. So take a look at that. It's up on the website, too. And all of this in your calls later on for Mark Headley. But first, let's find out the latest on American Ripper next. Was it true that H.H. Holmes was also Jack the Ripper? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Jeff Mudgett is the author of Bloodstains, as well as being the main character in the investigation involving his great-great-grandfather, the man who is generally recognized as America's first serial killer, H.H. Holmes. A fact that was hidden from him for most of his life until he got older, and then it was revealed to him by his grandfather. He has a degree in nautical industrial technology, which just kills me. That's so neat. And he serves as a commander in the United States Naval Reserves, or at least I should ask him. Are you still Commander Mudgett, Jeff?
No. I retired from that a long time ago went on to practice law in California.
Well, that's very cool. Then I'm reading an old bio, but I thought it was pretty neat, so I had to mention it. But Bloodstains is still available, right? It's in its second printing or something like that?
Oh, yeah. We're doing quite well with Bloodstains. As a matter of fact, Amazon Audible just took the digital audio of it and is making it available to anyone who wants to plug it into their cell phone and listen to it on the way to and from work.
I love that. So I went back and I rewatched. I had seen the promos for American Ripper, but I'd never watched the whole show from beginning to end. And then I started to when I knew you were coming on, and by coincidence, I had already booked Amaryllis Fox for last night on Coast, and then suddenly there she was popping up in the first episode. I'm thinking, okay, that is just too weird that happened. She was terrific last night. She talked very highly about you and your investigation and your approach to discovering whether Herman Webster Mudgett, your great-great-grandfather, also known by his, gnome to death, H.H. Holmes, that he was also Jack the Ripper. And so I watched the entire series since Friday, watched all 8 episodes. And I was surprised by the ending, to be honest. It seemed like for all of the buildup, it just like some of the ending popped up on a screen. And so I'm really dying to find out more about what has happened since that series had run. Can you tell me how happy you were with the ending of American Ripper?
You know, I'd love to, but before we start on that, I'd love to thank Coast to Coast, because when I first came on with you guys 5-6 years ago, you're the reason I got to make American Ripper. That's who
that's
contacted
awesome.
Me, the ones that were listening to the show, and they're the
oh,
ones
great.
That took off with History Channel and made it a possibility. So I owe Coast to Coast a huge thanks.
Well, there was Dave Schrader, I think. Is that who you were on with? Or
Dave Schrader and George Norrie, too.
And George both. Oh, that's terrific. Yeah, Dave's an old friend, too. Well, that's great. And so glad that you got that kind of traction. It was fascinating, right? And really well produced, and the graphics were great. But for all of the buildup about the DNA and the connection between you and H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper, it just kind of ended on a screen graphic, and then it was sort of done. And I thought, okay, is that the rest of the story? Is that everything we know now about your investigation into Jack the Ripper and whether or not he was your great-great-grandfather?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I, like you, thought the first 7 episodes were some of the best television
yep.
I'd ever seen, certainly
riveting.
Involved with. And the recreations and the actor that played Holmes and Jack in London was amazing television. That final episode there, I got to tell you, there was a lot of confusion going on. It was produced the last 2 days before it was actually broadcast. There were some major changes involving DNA results and the UPenn's idea about identity. And to be honest and to be fair to history, they had just Ian run out of time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if they had to do it all over again, they would have rather taken the time, moved it back a couple of weeks, and let us finish that last episode as well as the first seven had been done.
I believe that totally. My wife is an Emmy award-winning TV producer for Arizona PBS, and that happens a lot. It's just the time runs out and you got to get the show to market, and that's just all there is to it. You make the best show you can with what you got. But that's sort of the interesting thing. So before we go back to that point, let's run the timeline back to the beginning, because just so people understand, give the thumbnail on H.H. Holmes for people who don't know the story of his murder castle on the south side of Chicago.
Sure, I'd love to. H.H. Holmes, that was an alias for Herman Webster Mudgett, which makes him my great-great-grandfather, was a doctor from the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor that went the wrong direction, to tell you the truth, Ian. And this evil genius made his career planning for the Chicago World's Fair, where millions from all over the world were coming to see the latest inventions. Einstein, Edison, Tesla, the Wright brothers were there. It was an amazing place. And lo and behold, this evil doctor, my ancestor, built a hotel 2 miles down the road from the fair where he could put a vacancy sign out for the young tourists, mostly young, innocent women, to come stay with him, and then unfortunately visit the basement down below, which was, I try to explain it to people, but it's actually America's Dr. Frankenstein, and yeah. That basement was where murder was committed, where torture and evil medical experiments were conducted, and right in America, in Chicago, while the World's Fair was going on.
It was an abattoir in a lot of ways, And surprisingly, he was so good at getting away with it that he also sort of self-funded the entire operation by who he chose to murder and absorbing their assets.
The Chicago Tribune called him the greatest con that ever struck Chicago. He was as you mentioned, he could make money from any sort of fraud that he desired. He had one, I'd like to give you an example. He had one where he actually tapped into the city gas line and then sold the gas company back the gas that he had stolen from the line itself. But he used to make a living defrauding life insurance companies with substituted corpses, which he was strangely named as the beneficiary in their policies, and he'd take the policy and then prove the identity of the corpse as the main policyholder, and lo and behold, he'd end up with $30,000-$40,000, which in 1890 was a lot of money.
Sure, and that allowed him. Well, let's even go a little bit further. So, where was your great great grandmother in that?
She lived in New Hampshire. Her name was Clara, and Holmes Herman had married her when they were both 18 years old, and then she'd become pregnant. He had a son, which was my great-grandfather, and then he abandoned them both, went west. Chicago was the place of America at the time.
Opportunity, yeah.
And he ended up marrying three or four other women with scores of mistresses. Obviously, those weddings weren't legal. He was
right.
A bigamist, which the judge at his murder trial made a big point of pointing out to the jury. And so he abandoned them and only went back to them when he needed help, when the law was after him and he was trying to escape their grasp.
So, like a lot of narcissist sociopaths, it was all about him, and he was charming when he needed to be, manipulative at a drop of a hat, and good-looking, presented himself well, at least, if he wasn't, like, you know, necessarily movie star good looks. He dressed well. He had a good thing going, and he had the veneer of respectability. And so explain the murder castle just for people who don't know yet, or who haven't watched American Ripper or some of the other shows on him, on how it was designed as a death factory.
Yeah, it was located at 63rd and Wallace in Chicago, Inglewood, which was quite the place at the time. Now
Sure.
it's called the Murder Castle of the murder location of America. Now it's a tough place to be at night.
Right.
But it was at a place called Junction Grove, where the rail lines lined up that would go straight down to the fair or straight up to downtown. And Holmes picked that spot to build his hotel. It was three stories. It had a main floor with some of his businesses. He had assorted businesses down below, including glass factories, printing companies. He had a pharmacy where he could sell his medicine and collect the chloroform that he used quite commonly for some of his asphyxiations and murders. The second floor was the hotel with about 20 rooms. And then the third floor was his living quarters. And then, of course, in the basement was the infamous place where
Right.
a young lady would rent a room. He and his gang would see that gas was introduced into her room while she was sleeping. She would be rendered unconscious or dead, and then sent down a chute to where she would be strapped or tied to a gurney, and the doctor would descend the stairs to, conduct. I don't even know if America has
Right.
imagined the horrors that
We
went
don't
on
want to.
there.
Right.
While just down the road, some of the most amazing characters in world inventions, politics, everything were enjoying the World's Fair at the same time.
And he gets away with it for quite a while, but part of what you've discovered in American Ripper was that he was responsible for some things which he made are maybe not a part of the original understanding of what the scope of his crimes were.
Well, we started being fascinated in with the legend of the Holmes curse. When I wrote my book, my grandfather had told me this horrible secret he'd carried with him his whole life. I was about 40, and my grandfather, you could tell that he had had enough, being the only one that knew about his grandfather, this horrible man, and he needed some help with it. So I decided to see if I could go out and prove what was legend and what was lore,
Right.
mostly intending, Ian, to prove that this was a con, this was a fraud, this was a pathological liar, and these stories that were going round and round with all these books coming out weren't true. But the deeper I dug in the archives, the more the fact that this human demon, this prodigy of wickedness, hadn't even been identified properly in these books, and that they needed to go even further.
Right.
So when I went on shows like Coast to Coast and talked history into helping me with this, we started having questions about whether or not he had actually been executed in 1896.
Yeah, this is a really interesting piece that comes up toward the end, but I was even thinking about it at the beginning, when the missing cousins, when the folks were drowned back from when he was still known as Mudgett. And whether or not he had a hand in those.
He probably did. He was a master in forensic science, and he knew how to, once a murder was committed, eliminate any evidence whatsoever. I mean, he had a glass factory in Chicago where he could put human remains in and basically cremate anything left behind. He had a concrete factory where, if you remember on American Ripper, we actually went out into the Chicago River with sonar, engineers with boats with sonar, and found blocks, which we went to the city and asked for permission to actually dig up the Chicago River and dredge up to see what was inside those blocks. And We were. I was told we were refused. But funny thing, about 3 months after the show ended, I was at a party in Chicago, and the mayor's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel's chief of staff, came over to me and goes, "Man, we were all watching American Ripper. We love the show, especially the part about you guys finding those blocks in the Chicago River. Why didn't you come ask us if you could dig them up?" And I said, "Well, I thought we had, but
that could be good old fashioned." Chicago bureaucracy, though, too, right? Where the wrong person got asked the right question. All right, so let's pause, and we'll come back because we're just getting to the update part. I just wanted to lay the groundwork for people who didn't know it, and now we'll update what Jeff Mudgett has been able to discover since American Ripper ran. And we'll talk about the ending in the context of the relationship between H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper, and what still might be yet to discover next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Although not everybody realizes that song, Mac the Knife, which was the theme from the Three Penny Opera, is also based on a true story of a serial killer. It just happens to be one that was in Europe, not in the U.S., but it's a true story. If you go back far enough, I researched it for an article I wrote once. And I tell you what, we're going to get right back with Jeff Mudgett in just a moment, but a reminder for those people waiting that Mark Headley will join us at the top of the hour, and we'll get an update on what life is like for him since his big TV show ran. I see a theme tonight. We'll find out more about the update on American Ripper and what Jeff Mudgett hopes we will still learn in the future on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And there are a lot of parallels between the modus operandi of H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper. They worked concurrently. If they were the same person, it almost represented, a better way to say it, Jeff, I guess, is it would have shown an evolution in the way in which this narcissist sociopath had decided to become a killer. And like a lot of narcissist sociopaths, a lot of these people who do this type of serial killing, they start small. So maybe you could say, you know, drowning cousins, killing people within his family sphere, then leaving that area, and then going to eventually ending up in England, that it represented a kind of a series of an escalation of how he was looking at it. But if there was one constant, it was that in each case, whether he's H.H. Holmes or, as you propose, he's Jack the Ripper, he asphyxiates all of his victims first.
Not necessarily. There were quite a few in Chicago that he used the chloroform for asphyxiation first.
That's what I mean, though.
And that was his MO in Chicago. You're correct. While I was on my research about my relative, I was contacted by two or three gentlemen who had spent years believing that Holmes had a connection with those Whitechapel murders in 1888. And I, like everyone else, had my initial doubts. The story seems rather bizarre, strange, and out of this world to put much credence in. But I knew that, at the practice of law with using evidence, you've got to keep an open mind. You've got to take a professional look to see where it ends up. So I contacted the scientist at the University of Buffalo, Ian, who had created a computer program, which was used by the FBI, actually, to compare handwriting analysis. And, I had the testimony of experts, handwriting experts, saying that Holmes's handwriting was very, very similar to the Dear Boss letter, the famous Jack the Ripper letter, which was received by the press before the Catherine Eddowes murder. And I gave it to the University of Buffalo, and they tested and ran it and came back with these amazing similarity numbers. far beyond just coincidence.
Right.
And then, so then we started tracking, running down whether he could have been a passenger on cruise liners to London during that fall of 1888. And we found that there were indication that, but some of the aliases that he used, he had 31 of them. But some of those aliases were on the passenger list. And
including a Herman Holmes, right? I mean, sort of a combination of H.H. Holmes and Herman Mudgett.
Yeah, interesting. Dr. Howe, Dr. Harry Holmes, things like that. But there were many different ones. But one thing was common. The handwriting was very, very similar.
Right.
So that's when I went on your show, and that's when History contacted me about producing American Ripper. So when we went over to London producing the show, you know, the crew did an amazing job running down each piece of evidence that I had. And what I came to the conclusion of, Ian, is that there probably never will be a proof beyond a reasonable doubt who Jack the Ripper was. But I can tell you this, I'm a firm believer that the mystery has been solved and the case is closed, that we had an educated American who wrote the Dear Boss letter. If you remember, during American Ripper, we had two linguists, English linguists. Forensic linguists who studied the Dear Boss letter and said that, in their opinion, it was a well-educated American trying to sound English.
And there was an American doctor who was identified by a woman who ran a boarding house who notified police, and although they never were able to get him again, they did find the bag he had left behind, which was a doctor's bag, and inside it were instruments covered in blood, and it was an American. And so things like that do, I mean, it really does line up. I just want to go back to that MO thing, because I thought that was actually something I hadn't really considered. I think when we think of Jack the Ripper, maybe many of us, unless we really have studied it, people just think, well, he just came in and he just started cutting women in the alley and he started, but that really wasn't it. That wasn't how he did it. And it did, there was a certain continuity between getting these women into a private place where they were already unconscious, or he made them, rendered them unconscious, and then he started his evil experiments, much like what he did in Chicago.
That's exactly true. And what we, as we dug deeper, excuse the pun, Ian, but I came to the conclusion that history's been wrong for almost 130 years, that there had never been a Jack the Ripper serial killer. The phrase Jack the Ripper was invented by the author of the Dear Boss letter. It hadn't even existed on the first two murders that history calls the Ripper Five.
Right.
So when we began looking at that, you could see that the crime scenes weren't identical, that the Dear Boss letter hadn't even mentioned the previous two murders, and all criminal psychologists that I've talked to all agree that the author of Dear Boss would have mentioned the Nichols and Chapman murders had he been their killer. And I can tell you an interesting sidebar, but while we were in London, it was during the night of the presidential election, and the production crew were down drinking in their sorrow for the election of Donald Trump. I was at the bar of the hotel, and two officers from Scotland Yard came up to me at the bar, and they said, "Hey, we've been watching you guys in your production. We're interested in your theory about Ripper being an American doctor. We don't agree with you that it was H.H. Holmes, but we want to let you know this. We've, for at least a decade, believe that the Ripper involved a copycat," which rang a bell with me, because that's very close to my theory. Now, obviously, they didn't agree that H.H. Holmes, but they agreed that it was a copycat and that the Dear Boss letter had not been written by a journalist. It wasn't a hoax.
Right.
Because they believe that the author of Dear Boss then went on and murdered Catherine Eddowes.
Yeah. You know, the connection, that maritime connection, had come up before several times too. That the reason some people had argued that Ripper came in and then Ripper came out again was essentially with the tide, that he was in some sort of service, whether it was Merchant Marines or whether he was, in the Royal Navy or something. But okay, so we get to the eighth episode. It again, really captivating. If people haven't watched it on the History Channel, you can still watch it at history.com, but you either pay service or you can use your connection that you have to your cable provider to go back and watch it. And the eighth episode, you dig up the grave. You can determine that it that you do determine that it the body that's in the grave is H.H. Holmes, and you are related to the body that was in the grave, correct?
No, that's the history conclusion.
Okay,
That's
now
what I
then help
wanted
me
to
with
come
that.
on to your show and talk to
Good.
you about.
Okay, then straighten that out for me, because that was my takeaway, is that he that the forensic examination determined that that was in fact the body of H.H. Holmes in the grave, which would say then that he did in fact did not survive the hanging, that he did not swap another body in there using his money to get somebody else to take the fall for him while he escaped and then committed these other murders afterward, which are known as the Holmes curse, or ended up in England, right? That's the nexus of where the investigation stands.
So, correct. So when we were, we had talked, we had convinced the court in Pennsylvania to allow us to exhume the grave because there were questions about the murder trial itself, his incarceration, the alleged execution, the strange burial, and then his conversion to Catholicism to be buried in this one particular cemetery, Holy Cross, which was Catholic. So we talked the judge into allowing us to exhume the body, and to their credit, History stepped up and funded the entire project. They were great about the whole thing. It cost over $1 million, Ian, to exhume
Wow.
the body and test to see who was in that grave. Well, the court had ordered that DNA be used to identify the body. And I actually gave samples of my own to be
Right.
compared against what we dug up. Well, the University of Pennsylvania anthropologist who the court picked to do the testing walked away from the DNA because it didn't match. It couldn't, it, they, it was inconclusive, and they couldn't use it to identify who was there. They decided to use the dental records that they found in a report from a physician who visited Holmes while he was waiting execution. Well, I explained to the UPenn scientist that that's how Holmes made his living, with falsified dental records to defraud life insurance policies,
Sure.
companies. And I explained and I showed to them how those dental records weren't of a living person, they were of a corpse. I then explained to them that their measurements of the skeleton didn't match Holmes when he was living. And then we even actually went so far as to pull the neck vertebra and inspect it there in the lab at the UPenn, and it showed no signs of trauma, which is very, it's possible, but very, very unlikely when a man is dropped 5 feet through a scaffolding at the end of a rope, and the noose is designed by the hangman to
Sure.
snap the neck.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, Ian, and that's why I'm very grateful for you allowing me on your show, because I'm convinced that we've now proven that it wasn't Holmes in the grave, and that we're in the midst of the greatest criminal conspiracy in American history, and that this evil man, he not only avoided execution, he escaped justice, and he walked away free, having substituted another. We don't know if it was a living man or a corpse, but another in his place. And I can't wait for someone like history to step up and help me with this evidence, which I have no doubt whatsoever, proves that we've got another great mystery on our hands to solve involving my terrible ancestor.
Well, you would think that they'd be interested in another season, given how popular American Ripper was. I hope they do. If they don't, maybe there'll be somebody else who will step up and help fund it. Because to hear you describe it, at very least, and this is the beauty of American Ripper, is you did go down. You did find some dead ends. There were some moments where you very candidly, and Amaryllis Fox talked about this last night, where they tried to be as intellectually honest as possible in the presentation of this material that, yep, this didn't pan out, so now let's go down this road. And so keeping in that same theme, I think it would be fascinating to find out more and to use the test results that exist to help dig new holes, as it were, in history.
Well, and you know what? And I'm not saying I'm not. I just think the evidence was misinterpreted. There was no conspiracy on history's part in the UPenn. They were all doing a great job. Like I said, they ran out of time or money. But I think it's time to go back to look at it because it's when you have a court order, regarding DNA that didn't match. When you have a skeleton, I can tell you, when Amaryllis and I first walked into the lab at the UPenn to see the skeleton laid out by the anthropologists, and I'm glad you got a kick out of her. She's one of my best friends now. She's just an awesome lady.
Yeah, she's terrific.
We walked around the corner, and both of us were shocked. I hit her in the arm, and I said, "That's not a man. That's a monkey. It's too short. The arms are strange, and the legs are not right." And she just went speechless. She didn't say a word. But there were issues regarding that skeleton, which the UPenn scientists came back in and admitted that the body, when they dig up a body like that, they actually have an equation where they estimate how tall living that person would have been from the bones. And it came out 6 inches too short, Ian, from what Holmes was living. When we asked the UPenn scientists how that's possible, they made a joke about he must have been wearing lifts in his boots. And that's just not going to work in science.
And so let's be so I thought that the general agreement was that H.H. Holmes was around 5'8". And
Yes.
they thought the body was like about 5'4". So that would be a 4-inch swing between those two things, which is still significant.
Well, and in their press conference after the show, when they admitted that they were shocked to see history's conclusion, that final episode, the UPenn scientists, they didn't know anything about DNA numbers. When she was asked about the height of the skeleton, she did say 5'4", but then she said, "But that's stretching it."
Yeah, so to speak.
And that's the point I was trying to make. When
For a guy
Amaryllis
who was
and I first
hanged.
saw it, we both knew it wasn't 5 feet. It was too short.
Right. Well,
So
very interesting.
there's something wrong. There's something not adding up. And I think science, I think American history, and I think the 1.4 million people that watched that final episode are entitled to the truth.
Well, again, I thought they did a terrific job. I thought it was really interesting to watch, and I thought you and Amaryllis were, you had really nice chemistry, and I thought the whole thing is as shows like that go, that was masterful. But the ending was just abrupt. It kind of reminded me of a couple of movies that I've loved, but where suddenly it was like they ran out of money, so. The main character got hit by a bus, that kind of thing. So I was that part surprised me because it did seem like there was more to be said. So if you're open to somebody else coming along, are you writing a sequel? Are you working on a book to explore this? Because I think 1.4 million people having watched, that final episode, you find a few people who are wanting to buy another book. Is Bloodstains updated with the new material at the end?
No, it's not. But I got to tell you this, we're working on a couple of projects right now. And once again, coast to coast, someone learned that I was going to be on your show tonight. They wanted to know if it was possible, if I'd be interested in another television show. So maybe
Good.
coast to coast is going to get me my second show.
Good. Well, and then so terrific for that. And then Amaryllis Fox, we were talking about how Apple TV bought the rights to her book, and they're going to make that
Awesome.
a movie.
Awesome.
Did you not hear about that? Brie Larson
No,
is,
that's the first.
yeah, Captain Marvel. Brie Larson is involved, so that'll be cool. So maybe you'll both have competing projects coming out this year, and then also work together on a sequel for American Ripper.
Do you have a quick second for me to give you an Amaryllis story?
Yeah, I got 60 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, while we were digging the grave, while when that concrete was opened up and that horrible face was looking up at us, and the
Yeah.
Archdiocese of Philadelphia was whispering in my ear, he said, "My son, are you sure you know what evil you release here today?" And I'm like getting
Right.
chills. I'm getting chills. And the scientists are down in the grave. And the director, Mark Perez, who's a great director, great TV man, he said, Jeff, we need you to jump down in the grave and dig with the scientists. And I said, I'm not going to hell down there. And Amarillo says, I'll go. And she jumps down and she starts digging away.
Yeah, she always seemed good to go on the show, she really did, and I love the fact that she never seemed afraid to get dirty on any of those on any aspect of those investigations. Well, thank you so much, and we look forward to an update. So you'll let us know then when we can update what you've been able to get for American Ripper Part 2, and we'd love to tell everybody about it. Thank you. And Blown for Good, Mark Headley is back with an update too. It's like a theme this weekend on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.